Thank you, and welcome back.
The second panel, Keep It in the Closet.
The historic speculation around Michael Jackson's gender-bending persona, moderated by Stephen Fullwood, who is the Black Gay and Lesbian Archivist here at the Schomburg, and is responsible also for the Hip Hop Project. He is also a publisher, a writer, a thinker, and I think the perfect person to lead this conversation. So if we could welcome Stephen Fullwood.
Hi. Before we begin, we're going to play a clip for you to kind of give you some context for our conversation today.
There's something I have to say to you. If you promise, you'll understand. I cannot contain myself when in your presence. I'm so hungry.
She was, give it all she was, she did.
At this time, I'd like to invite my fellow panelists on stage, DJ Reborn, Asad Muhammad, and Mark Anthony Neal. Oh, and I thought that she was on her way, but apparently she's here. DJ Selly. Where are you? DJ, is she here? Hey, come on up. Hey, DJ. We have another treat for you before we start in on the conversation. It's to also to give us some context for this conversation today about Michael Jackson. Yeah, wherever that kid is, yeah. Yeah, exactly. About keeping it in a closet, the historical speculation about Michael Jackson and his gender-bending persona. And so, you ready?
And of those who claimed that her son was gay, Catherine called them liars.
Michael's not gay. He's not gay, I'm here to say. And this is what a lot of people think, is because the way he looked. But you can tell when a person's gay. Sometimes you look in his face and you can say, oh my God, that
out.
Guy's gay. You can tell from your
movement. Pay attention.
Wow.
Well.
Okay then. Thank you, Catherine.
Before I begin, I want to thank Lene, Clarice, Ashley, the Wild Sea Cultural Group, and the Schomburg Center for putting together and hosting this meeting of the minds about the life and impact of Michael Jackson and his music. This is a conversation we'll be having that will outlive all of us, you know. Keep it in the closet. I contend that Michael Jackson didn't keep anything in the closet, that we saw everything, or maybe we didn't see anything. Maybe in him, in his performance, we saw ourselves, our desires, our wants, disappointments. Maybe it was the best of ourselves and the worst. His life and genius embodies the tensions and obsessions with the world regarding race, gender, sexuality, physical transformation via plastic surgery, wealth, and power. It seemed to be all out there. And we often talk about Michael like we were doing today, like we knew him and what he was going through. So here's what we believe we knew or know about Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson was born. He was a boy, a son, a brother, a teenager, a man, a husband, a father, the king of pop, the most famous person in the world. Here's what's often said about Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson was a homosexual, a child molester, a criminal, a eunuch, a pedophile, a freak, a faggot, was on the DL, was the queen of pop. Wacko Jacko, as the media dubbed him. While preparing for today's event, a scene from the film Car Wash came to mind. There was, remember Lindy? Lindy was this man, played by Tamara Fargas, who was in a wig and makeup. He's homosexual. And so he gets in an argument with another character by the name of Duane, who's a black nationalist, played by the late, great Bill Duke. Surrounded by all the other car wash employees, Duane calls him a sorry-looking faggot. She's just another poor example how the system is destroying our men. To which Lindy responds, honey, in this type of voice too, honey, I'm more man than you'll ever be and more woman than you'll ever get. The workers double over with laughter, and Lindy, in a wig and makeup, scarf tied around her neck, is taken as he or she is in the film. The way she is. And although Michael Jackson never came out of his mouth the way Lindy did, it's important to consider how he performed gender, masculinity, femininity, asexuality, and all these other things to his advantage, and sometimes to our squeamishness. How, in fact, Michael was in some ways more man than most of us will ever try to be simply by being who he wanted to be. That self-determination Arthur Jaffa talked about today? Exactly. And a more woman than any of us dare try to be by wearing wigs. Yes, Michael wore wigs and makeup, and by flouting masculine conventions in our conservative black faces. I was chosen to moderate this panel because of the work I do here at the Schomburg. I am the project director for the Hip Hop Archive and the Black and Lesbian Archive, and both projects offer me repeated opportunities to think and rethink how black men, homosexual and heterosexual, perform masculinity as well as transgress it. I accepted the role as moderator because I love thinking about Michael Jackson and his impact on people, on the music industry, on modern dancing, videos, paparazzi, and the culture of celebrity, and in effect, the world. I want the panelists to consider Michael Jackson's gender-bending performance in his videos, concert footage, news footage, from both an individual perspective as well as a witness in what the community thinks perspective. How does gender performance operate within black communities here and abroad? How did Michael Jackson's morphing from brown to white, male to feminized male, complete with wigs and makeup again, disturb our expectations of conventional black masculinity? And what were the consequences of transgressing these boundaries? Do black male entertainers get a pass to be eccentric, flamboyant, Prince, Little Richard, Luther Vandross? Or why is or was Michael Jackson's sexuality important to this community? Why do people conflate sexuality and pedophilia? Our esteemed panelists, again, Asadat Mohammed, DJ Reborn, DJ Selly, and Mark Anthony Neal, are here to address a few questions I have, and we're going to leave enough time for you to get to that mic and to join in on conversation. Y'all ready?
Yeah.
Let's begin. Mark Anthony Neal. Mark Anthony Neal.
What's up?
How you doing, man?
I'm good.
Mark Anthony Neal wrote a book called The New Black Man, and in it he talks about how he's developed his feminist sort of consciousness. And I thought in the phrase, I think it's black feminist manhood is the phrase, which I really love. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that concept, as well as how Michael Jackson fits in it or doesn't fit in it, to sort of begin this conversation.
So what's a black feminist manhood, right? A black masculinity, a black manhood to take seriously, the critiques that black feminism, womanism has made over a period of time. You'd be surprised if you Google black male feminists, you actually will find hundreds of them on Google. So it's not like this is some sort of outlier concept. But in the case of Michael Jackson, you know, I think it gets a little complicated because I think we can't easily conflate Michael Jackson's willingness to push the boundaries of black masculinity as being one and the same with some sort of engagement with black feminist thought.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways does his work, for instance, privilege the narratives of black women? I think, you know, if you were to compare him to one of his musical peers, Luther Vandross,
mm-hmm.
And to think about the way that Luther Vandross, and this is not my argument, you know, the way that Luther Vandross and his music clearly spoke to the heterosexual desires of black women, not in they heterosexually desired Luther, but
right.
The music itself was, you know, he was their gay friend, you know, for lack of a better, their gay buddy for lack of a better way to describe it. You don't necessarily see that component in Michael Jackson's music.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in absence of knowing, you know, real hardcore personal narratives about what his relationship might have been with his sisters, with Janet, with Diana Ross, and the range of other black women who came into his orbit, we don't really know what his feminist politics are.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, because of the soft voice and the kind of performance of masculinity that he did, it's easy to think of him as being soft in a very traditional sense and thus not invested in patriarchy,
mm-hmm.
right, in very traditional ways.
Nice, nice. DJ Selly, how
yes.
you doing?
Hi.
How you doing? I'd like to ask you a little bit about, just sort of talk about how black male entertainers operate for us in the black community. Do you think they get a special pass to be eccentric, to be more feminine? Think about Prince, think Sylvester, think Little Richard, and then sort of kind of talk about it personally, but also as a person who's witnessed other black folks talking about them, like how they regard it.
How do they regard sexuality within...
Well, maybe not the sexuality, but how they regard it as images. We weren't taught to grow up to be like Prince, necessarily. Do you know?
True. I mean, you know, Prince had his own flair. I think that if you measure Prince, maybe, you know, next to Luther Vandross, they're very dynamically different people and performers.
Mm-hmm.
Prince, being very flamboyant, could at some point be perceived as homosexual. Clearly, he is not.
When you say clearly he's not, exactly what does that mean?
I mean that Prince, I think that Prince definitely demonstrates that he is, one, a sexual being, but one who is a sexual being who affiliates his sexuality with, you know, women, like liking women, enjoying the company of women.
Mm-hmm.
And he does assert that, in spite of the fact of his garb and whatever he chooses to dress up as. Mm-hmm. You know, that was, I think, more prevalent in his past than it is, you know, as a middle-aged performer.
Mm-hmm.
And in talking about somebody like Luther Vandross, you know, you have somebody in the traditional construct of a male singer, suit, tie, well-groomed, very traditionalist-looking, mm-hmm. but has led his, you know, personal life, I believe, a lot of the time in the closet. And he was a closeted artist for a very long time until, you know, finally I believe he was outed, and it was just who he was, and we accepted that.
But if Luther doesn't come out, is he really gay? This notion of a closet?
Of course he is.
Of course? Well, it's interesting how you say that Prince is demonstrative. You know, he demonstrates heterosexuality in his music.
Yes.
And what we see about his personal life, but that Luther was outed at one point. I've never read that, but I just thought it was one of those things.
To a point in Luther's career that everybody knew, you know, the nature of his sexuality,
mm-hmm.
and we were okay with that. I think I was less comfortable with knowing that this man was kind of tunneled into this world of, you know, heterosexual singing and life, and there was no place for him to sing about the love I felt that he felt as a gay male artist,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then when you bring Michael Jackson into that picture, it's very camouflaged in terms of the way, you know, he physically appears, right. his garb, etc. Now, I don't believe, I've never seen Michael parading around. Yes, there have been wigs, and there are also, you know, the incident where his scalp was burned. So there may be reasoning behind those things.
Why he was actually wearing wigs.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, you know, with the reputed vitiligo and all of that, you know, the skin and the makeup.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never viewed Michael Jackson as somebody who was extremely flamboyant and openly and overtly, you know, if you want to put out the word gay, I never viewed him as that type of artist.
Okay.
And in terms of a free pass, I think that black artists across the board are heavily scrutinized,
mm-hmm.
No matter what angle they take, whether it's, you know, a Jimi Hendrix, you know, playing a guitar and perming his hair and playing rock and roll, you know, or a Prince or a Michael Jackson. When you have somebody, you know, who changes the way you think about music, and they happen to be a person of color, I feel that there's definitely heavy scrutiny around not only the way they present themselves as an artist, but, you know, their sexuality and everything that is personal about them now is questionable, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, who they really are. Mm-hmm. And then their personal lives then become our business, or so we think. I never felt that way. I felt like Michael was somebody who struggled to keep some sense of a personal life and a mm-hmm. personal...
Something, he kept something for himself.
He wanted
to. There was a public
persona. He wanted to, but I don't think that, you know, I think that there were so many things that attacked him all of those lies and the convoluted nature of, you know, the media and the stories that surrounded him and the trials and, you know, the possible or alleged pedophilia, all of those things came into play, and we weren't really sure at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Who this person was sexually. Do I think it was any of our business? No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my take on
that. Stephen, if I could hop in for a quick
Absolutely.
Second. I think one of the things that's always important when thinking about Michael's performance of masculinity, look at his peers in the late 1970s and early 1980s. I mean, mm-hmm. when Michael was still an R&B artist.
Right.
Right, before he's a king.
Flirting with disco. Flirting with disco.
And disco, right? So when you think about Sylvester, right, and of mm-hmm. course, Sylvester may be the most flamboyant black male artist we've ever seen.
Exactly.
When you think about Prince in that context, when mm-hmm. you think about Luther Vandross, I mean, I actually disagree. I mean, Luther Vandross was incredibly flamboyant, right? This is a man who was on stage with sequined suits that matched the sequin gowns of his background, right? And he was the one who designed the gowns.
Well.
Right. And then and even somebody that we rarely think about in this context, right, Rick James,
yeah.
Right, who at his peak had braids, you know, with glitter in them,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a period of time in which the performance of masculinity across the board, again, Michael's also trying to break through into the MTV world. What does white rock look like?
Right.
And I mean, they're all doing this gender-bending, gender-fuck performance,
absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, if you read them, if you read all of this together, Michael actually comes off as performing a rather tame masculinity mm-hmm. at that point in time, mm-hmm. right? But of course, he's already been feminized in our minds,
exactly.
right? Because of the voice, right?
Right?
Particularly as a child, the childlike voice, right? Mm-hmm. In comparison to his brothers or what we think of as Joe Jackson's voice in that kind mm-hmm. of context. And this desire to keep him small, right? And I think, you mm-hmm. know, the great way that Esther described it, right? There was a perversion, there was a kind of perverse nature associated
right.
with it,
mm-hmm.
right? This little boy who kind of sounds like a girl, and again, I disagree, you know, Esther, I think there was something sexual about how people
no,
reacted.
No, I agree. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, when you hear Michael Jackson sing Who's Loving You, right, it's clear that he has knowledge of something that he shouldn't have knowledge of as a 10-year-old. Right.
Or
we talk about child.
That he's been exposed to some carnal knowledge, right, that he shouldn't have, that he has the ability to perform mm-hmm. that necessarily he shouldn't have had access to.
On that Chillin' Circuit, they talk about the Jackson 5 actually going to these strip clubs and performing late
right,
at night
exactly.
and
right.
him watching his father and also the naked women.
Right.
And that had something to do with the way he was sort of shaped. And Margo Jefferson in her book, this really, really wonderful book on Michael Jackson, she talks about this sort of fetishization of child performers. And Michael kind of fits that for mm-hmm. me because he was at whatever, it's what Nelson George said yesterday when he says he went all over the world and everyone had a Michael Jackson of their own. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what they did with that kid. And I also agree that Michael was aware of a lot of things.
Yeah.
So the voice, and the right. question I have for you deals with the voice and the notion of femininity or feminizing that Michael Jackson. Years and years ago, the rumor was that Michael Jackson was castrated by Joe Jackson so that he can continue singing at a high voice so that he was a cash cow for the Jacksons. Who's loving you? You know, it's Michael Jackson. Who's loving you? You know, it's a very different thing. So my question after, actually, I'm going to skip the voice one and go to When Bad Comes Out. Mm-hmm. I remember being at work and being called on the phone and said, you got to see this Bad video, Stephen. So I came home and I watched it. And I remember being so turned off by Michael Jackson's transformation that I couldn't hear the music. I just couldn't hear it. I couldn't hear it until I heard Another Part of Me. And I was like, okay, I'm back on board. But I kept on going, why did Michael look like this? And so my question to you, when Michael was sort of changing, he was doing several different things. He was in the video, The Way You Make Me Feel, chasing after a woman that sort of looked like a whiter LaToya, and LaToya's in the video too, and then Michael's kind of looking more effeminate and more, but he's also grabbing his crotch, and he's becoming very sexually aggressive. He's chasing some woman down with a gang. So,
in an alley.
In an alley. He corners her in the alley. Talk about your experiences about Michael Jackson's transformation and how the community around you responded to it.
Yeah, it's interesting because for me, Arthur Jaffa mentioned earlier sort of the steady decline after Thriller in Michael's music. And for mm-hmm. me as a fan, I was letting go as the decline was happening. And so with Bad, visually with the video, I think I was saw the subtle and not so subtle changes that kept happening along the way. So by the time, you know, the Bad video comes out, I'm like, well,
wow.
I mean,
wow.
I'm not shocked. But then interestingly, in my family, my father was a Jackson 5 fan, not a Michael Jackson fan during the Thriller era mm-hmm. and during sort of this transformative, ultra-feminine expression of self. But something happened with my father when Bad came out. He was back on it.
Wow.
Loved Bad. Like, we used to fight about the Bad tape in the car. I'd be like, Daddy, please don't play Bad again. Like, loved the song, was into the video, was on board with Michael Jackson, but had critiqued him and criticized him for becoming mm-hmm. feminine before that. But there was something about Bad that spoke to my father as a man, as a black man who identified as a heterosexual being,
wow.
where he was able to overlook the sort of feminine aesthetic of Michael Jackson and the lightening of the skin. My dad was very critical of people who, quote, wanted to be white. So for him to let the music be the most dominant thing that he could respond to, I thought was really significant, because for me, I was kind of backing away at that time from him.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. When I was a kid, I remember about the sixth grade, that it was no longer important for me to be smart. It was important for me to be a boy. And thus, the boy training started in. And so, aside, I was thinking about Michael Jackson's boy training, so to speak. He had brothers. He traveled with these brothers. They were on the road a lot together. They slept in the same bed. Michael Jackson was markedly different when you see him in younger performances with his brothers. His brothers, you know, they're a little older and they're, you know, a little bit more, quote-unquote, male. But Michael Jackson, there's something a little tender about him, a little vulnerable. Talk a little bit about how you see Michael Jackson's boy training, so to speak.
So I saw that Michael said that he loved his father, but he didn't really know him. And I know that was true for me, and I think a lot of black boys. And I think that many times fathers are learning how to be a man in the process of rearing a child, because being a father can stretch you, and in that stretching, you are trying to factor in, how am I going to bring up this young boy to maybe one day be a father of their own? I think that boyhood training is learning to mimic, learning not to be a critical thinker, to do what boys do and just do what you have to do to get along. Right. And I think that's also tired. I think it's old,
authorized.
Worn out.
It's authorized by our community. It's authorized by our community to do this often.
So the way that he was trained as a boy, I think many people could relate to, in terms of, but then it was different because he had an audience that was loving the fact that he was sensitive and gentle and had these other parts to himself. I think that's what attracted so many people to him. So many times we criticize what the attraction is. Many people are attracted to people who don't fit the mold of what it is to be, you know, this idea, like you bringing new thoughts, new actions. But it's like, you know, they heal you and then they nail you. You know, it's like he didn't have the space to, you know, he was doing things where we had to catch up, you know, and I think that sometimes there are people in the world and in our lives that do that to us, where it's like, you know, I'm showing you a different type of boyhood, but that he tried to stretch as he got older, you know, like the man boy. And that dynamic plays out in other parts of people's lives when they can't take care of their children, or they still hang around doing the same things, having the same thoughts, and you have boy thoughts in a man's body. So I think that boy-man thing is not just a Michael thing. It's like...
It's maybe a malehood thing?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Was Michael on the down low? Let's just get this out the way. DJ Sally? You can all answer it, actually. I like your perspectives on this. And I mean it to be tongue-in-cheek, because I think I want to sort of play with it, so...
I think Michael spanned the range of sexuality in so many ways. There were so many gray areas when we look at him and what he showed us in terms of his performances and his assertion as a man. And as the panel brings out, as a very sensitive man, as a boy man, you know, all of those things. In my heart, I do not believe that he was gay or on the down low. I just don't see that. I think his mother's commentary that Lene just shared with us is comically naive, that you can tell. However, just based on the things that I've read, I mean, you know, we can all sit here and speculate about who we thought this man was sexually. You know, only the very intimate details of his life are known by himself and those who shared those details. So with that, I can share my opinion, which is I do not believe that he was on the down low or, you know, having relations with children either. Mm-hmm. I think there were a lot of questionable things that happened in the range of his life and his dealings with children specifically. However, I don't feel like he was... I don't think he was on the down low. No, mm-hmm. To answer the question, I don't believe that.
Let me change the language.
Go right ahead.
You know, we've been talking about whether or not Michael was gay, and I agree with DJ Selly. I don't think Michael was gay, but was Michael queer?
Can you tell? Share with the audience what you mean by queer versus
gay. I
think
that's a different question, right? If you think about queer, you know, as a theoretical term, right? It's specific definition of it's something that's strange and oppositional, right? And strange and oppositional in the context of what we see as a normative performance of masculinity. I think in that context, Michael Jackson clearly was queer, right?
Clearly.
But as AJ mentioned in his presentation, you know, Michael was also, you know, Michael wasn't, for all the artistry that we talk about him, right, he was a commercial animal, right? He wanted to sell records. He wanted to sell more records than anybody possible. And you don't sell 100 million records without selling 100 million records to every possible person in the room, which means you learn how to market and promote yourself in a way that's complex and multifaceted that speaks very different things to very different audiences. So that when you hear, you know, the question that came in, that last question about, you know, how every different person had a different opinion of him, that wasn't accidental. I mean, that was Michael trying to reach as many audiences as possible. And if you look at, you know, the state of black R&B at the beginning of the 1980s, and if Michael wants to sell 100 million records, Michael has to be able to be on the wall, the bedrooms, the little white girls, and big posters.
Exactly.
And how does he do that if he comes off as a threatening hyper... He can't be Teddy Pendergrass.
He can't be Mike Tyson.
Just to put that in some sort of context, right? He doesn't sell 100 million records as Teddy. I mean, that's the reason why Teddy Pendergrass doesn't sell 100 million records, right? Because in terms of the whole history of black masculine sexuality, Teddy Pendergrass scared the shit out of a bunch of folks.
Right.
Close the door.
Right. Even if he had the capability of coming off as sensitive and introspective, that if you really listen closely to his music, is clearly there. When you see the stories of Rick James, right? And some of y'all may be too young to remember the battles between Rick James and Prince.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there was an incredible, you know, jealousy between the two of them. And Prince would show up at Rick James concerts, right, with his little bodyguards carrying him on like a little throne, like going through the aisles, right? Because they were both vying for the same audience, right? The, you know, they were kind of legacies of Jimi Hendrix. They wanted to be, you know, what did Rick James call his music? Punk funk, right? He was trying to cross over in that sort of context. They're both vying for this, and Michael was like, neither one of y'all are going to cross over because you're too hypersexual, right? You're too hypermasculine, despite the little glitter in your hair and the bikinis on stage when you open in for the Rolling Stones and all that kind of stuff. And so Michael had to perfect a performance, right? Peter Pan, that was non-threatening, that was soothing everybody. I mean, so their parents, right? You're talking about, you know, this is a generation that the parents are like, we can't have any rock and roll in the house.
Yeah, the typical gore, yeah.
Parents have to be able to go, oh, that's safe, right? That's good music. Right? We'd invite Michael over to dinner, right? Right? Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan at the White House. Let's give Michael Jackson an award. Right? You know, because he's such a great role model. Right? I mean, so all of that was very calculated, right? And he understood that if he performed a certain kind of queer black masculinity, right? It would get him access to those audiences that he wouldn't necessarily have access to.
Nice. Nice.
I think that the world is obsessed with what black men do with their penises.
Boom.
Yes.
I do. It amazes me that it doesn't matter how famous you could be, what you could bring to the world, like, it's like, were you gay? Like, if Jesus was to walk in a room, like, we'd be like, tag, is he get, you know, like, limp wrist. Like, it's all about, you know, like, you can't get away from speculation, you know. No, black leadership, you know, does not, like, we tear each other down with, even with statements where we're trying to protect, you know. Because I don't hear people say, like, and this is just to follow what you said on DJ Sully, because I don't hear people say, like, in my heart, I believe that he is gay. Like, I don't hear people say in my heart, somebody's gay, which means, it's like, are we programmed to assume that the congregation is straight? Like, should I be programmed to look in the audience and be like, yeah,
that one, straight, that crowd, one, like, that, you know, one, yeah.
Well, you can look in their face and tell.
Right. Okay.
Catherine Jackson knows. If you don't know, Catherine does, yeah.
So, I don't know what he was doing with his sex organs. But I think that I think what he did for a lot of men who were queer, I think that he stretched the imagination of what a man could be, which is important because we should all be growing. Like, we should not be limited to this one box of, you know, I have to be able to intimidate women and intimidate other men. So to be a being who's not about, your main goal is not about intimidation, but can I get you to think about certain things that you have never thought about? You know, can I get you to imagine a world where, like, you know, people said, like, you can't be Jamaican and Muslim. Hold on, you can't be Jamaican and there's no gay Jamaicans and you can't be this and you can't. But can you challenge people to be like, you know, yes, actually, I do exist, and I think that's what he did. I think he was like, I'm going to exist. Like, you never met another me. And I think that's why he's so important, because we never met another Michael Jackson.
I love it, because I love what you're saying, because Michael, I know several people, dancers, who can dance like Michael Jackson, but there's something not there. Do you know? And it's more than just Michael did it first. It's about who he was and the sort of, this man was famous for most of his life.
You mean like Usher, right?
Like Usher? You trying to start a fight up in here? Well, these are Michael Jackson fans, so now you, baby.
There are so many things that I want to say about this. Is that Lene mentioned earlier the connection between, you know, Toni Morrison and Michael Jackson. And for me, one of the things that I've been saying for a while is that if I didn't live in the same lifetime as Michael Jackson, I would believe that he was a character that someone wrote. The complexities and the incredible genius are unfathomable on a certain kind of level. And yes, he was a human being, and there are geniuses all over the place and extremely talented people in this room and just out on the street and in the world who will never be known. But he is almost unreal, otherworldly, because of all the isms, because of all the talent, because of, you know, Gary Indiana, because of the King of Pop, he runs the gamut of all the isms that we could ever encounter, especially as black people. And I think that we as black people, and a lot of people in general, have a desperation about sameness.
Oh, yeah.
And how are you different? Why are you different? Okay, you're gay. Okay, well, no, you're not gay. Like, what's this desperation about sameness that we have in conformity? That's one.
Nice.
When Mark Anthony Neal talked about queer, and in my notes, and one of the things that I was researching about is this idea of, like, gender queer and gender fluidity. And Michael Jackson was very gender fluid. And he was also, again, a person who performed black masculinity in every traditional, stereotypical way that we think of it, but nobody was buying it. And that's the difference. He wasn't intimidating like we're all talking about. So he performed violence in his videos. He's smashing car windows. Mm-hmm. He wants to start a fight. You're not a man. The sexual aggression, he's chasing a chick down the alley. That's very unsafe. You know what I'm saying? Like, what? This dude is following me in an alley in the middle of the night and
even
breaking windows.
Even if it's Michael Jackson, you're like, damn.
But he's Michael Jackson, right. So I'm not buying it. And shaming of weaker men. All these things that are, like, performances of stereotypical black masculinity, Michael Jackson did all those things. But at the same time, he was constantly having a physical dialogue with all of us by changing his appearance, by seeming effeminate. Mm-hmm. So these things were happening all at the same time. And then one of the last things I want to say is that I read this quote yesterday, and it's, like, rolling around in my head. And it was just something I found online, and it says, though he was a constant crotch grabber, that was more of a statement of him wanting to remove his penis than, rather than an affirmation of its existence.
I can't.
What? Blow. All right?
What?
So, you want to say it again?
Say it again.
Though he was a constant crotch grabber, that was more of a statement of him wanting to remove his penis rather than an affirmation of its existence.
Who the hell
wrote
that? Damn. It was someone responding online, a comment left as part of a larger article.
Okay.
Just a random person. And I just thought it was a very compelling statement. Problematic, compelling, interesting, thought-provoking. You guys do with it what you will.
Wow.
So, interesting.
Interesting. I love what you're saying about this whole physical dialogue thing, this transformation right in front of us. Mm-hmm. Our conventions about masculinity, femininity, asexuality are always sort of in dialogue, and the tensions are there, and people don't really know how to do it. So you might have someone whose investment in masculinity and femininity is so strong, they're like, he's a faggot, he's this, he's that, mm-hmm. he's this. And I'm often perplexed when people speak about someone that's not themselves as being truth. I'm
right.
I'm like, this is what I think about this person. And so those comments are a little bit more easier for me to hold. Mm-hmm. But most people don't even know about themselves. And so I think the notion of Michael Jackson as sort of a shape-shifting, gender-bending, he is a character. Mm-hmm. He is a character. I mean, Michael Jackson, you have to, sometimes, I remember at one point I had to ignore the image so that I can enjoy the music. And then I remember when he died, like everybody else, I think there was a guy in the New Yorker who said he was wondering what the music for the summer would be, and it was like, no, Michael Jackson. It didn't matter who had an album out. Michael Jackson was selling when he was dead. Every single time Michael Jackson got in trouble, his album sales would go up. What do you do? I mean, what are we talking about? So there was something sort of visceral and something that he tapped into that I think kept us interested in him. You know, that video, Just Leave Me Alone, I think that was one moment where I went, okay, Michael knows what's being said about him, and he's very calculated, you know, and he wants to say something back about that. The other moment that I had that was similar to that was watching Martin Bashir's first documentary. You remember that time when Michael Jackson was walking around, and he was going, I want one of those, two of those, 800 of those. He was just doing all this stuff, right? And then Martin Bashir, don't you think this is a bit, ostentatious, I forget exact wording. Then Michael goes, doesn't even look at the man, goes, that's my taste. One of those, and keeps on moving. So it's like Michael knew the extent of his power. He knew he could have certain things. And I think in some ways, by inviting Martin Bashir in, he wanted to have that conversation about who he was. It was supposed to normalize him, but by the time it got to the kid conversation, there he is again. There's nothing wrong with sharing your bed with a kid. And they're like, you're 41, 42, you know, however old you are. He was defiant in it almost, you know. And he had a couple opportunities to recant or go, yeah, there's something wrong with it. I'm really sorry, y'all. He didn't. Michael Jackson continued to push at those boundaries. So it was easy to kind of think of him as a character. Do you know?
Can I just say something
go right
about you talking about the obvious line with the kids that was blurred.
Mm-hmm.
At best, it was blurred. One of the things that I think of when I think about Michael Jackson, and some people may not take this seriously, but I believe deeply in astrology. And Michael Jackson being a Virgo not only speaks to sort of the tendency of perfection that I have experienced people in that sign to have and their level of brilliance, but Virgos are the virgin in the zodiac, and they have a very strong sense of purity that is also not appropriate for the world that we live in and the times that we live in. So as clear as it is that if you're 45 years old and you have kids in your bed that are not your children, that there's something about that that raises red flags, I believe deeply that as calculating and as brilliant as Michael Jackson was, his Virgo-ness, virgin, pure qualities and sensitivity level, and his apparently being stunted emotionally as a child by being told he was ugly, by the abuse. There are all these things that sort of locked him into childhood that I think are very significant, and they cannot be under stated in this conversation about, like, this Virgo man who is a perfectionist but who also had these very virgin energies.
Robin, just to couple that with the fact that he had created his own world and had been living in that world.
Right.
For probably over 20 years. He'd been living in this fantasy world that he created. And maybe in that context, you know, coupled again with the things that Robin just pointed out, maybe he really didn't see anything wrong with that. He didn't get it. He was in his own reality.
Right.
And it is so, I can only imagine, by far different than anything that we experience as adults, as a 40-year-old adult, as a 45, as a 50-year-old adult. Those things are, again, unfathomable to us to share a bed with a child.
I suspect they're unfathomable to him as well. I just feel like he chose this deliberately, defiantly, almost.
Oh, well.
So, Jimmy, so I don't think the notion of an innocence, the Virgo tendencies, that sort of thing, I think he definitely chose.
He chose, he still had that sort of, underlying belief that nothing was wrong with it. Mm-hmm. Although he was choosing it, and although I think he could even tell why other people were having a problem with it, he chose it in part because of his power, in part because I'm Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Arthur referenced earlier, I'm going to do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell me I can't sleep with 10 kids that aren't mine, but guess what? If they come over, it's happening.
I wouldn't say it's interesting to hear two of you speak of it. I think of men who are closeted now, who seems to create their own worlds to live in because the world is not prepared for them to live in.
Uh-huh.
So I think, like, there's so many, you know, when you don't create safe spaces to either be considered to do childlike things, be able to do childlike things that 30 years old, 40 years old, like, when you don't have a space to do that, you have to create your own world. And, like, when you don't have the space to, you know, it's definitely a class issue, too, because...
No, definitely.
Black men have enough money to even properly express who they are sexually because they have to continue to live in the neighborhoods they live in where they're being oppressed by people that look
definitely.
Just like them.
You can move out of your neighborhood, but it's been said that black queer folk don't want to move away from black folk.
Right. And why should you have to? I mean...
Right, exactly. If this is your family. This is your family.
So how do we create... Where do black people who are being oppressed by other black people go to create other spaces of family?
Uh-huh.
Like, where and why and how does it feel to have to do that?
Mm-hmm.
There is some survival skills in that, but it's also some pain, you know? Like, his father told him that his nose was too big, you know? To think about the pain that your words can do to people and, like, where did that all go for Michael?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it went into him being a child and him being able to, like, depend on the money when he couldn't, you know, use the money to build the world that he wanted to create. So he used his resources. And I think many of us, like Lene was speaking about, like, if we had the money to make changes about our bodies and about ourselves, many of us would take it and run with it. My parents were from Jamaica, and they came here seeking freedom and not freedom, but more so options.
Uh-huh.
And they're intertwined. And I think that he was chasing options, but when you're not Michael Jackson, how do you get to live your options freely?
How do you become the thing that you are, or that you want to, or you see yourself being? There's an article in a book called Think Again by a guy named Roderick Ferguson. It's called Sissies at the Picnic. And at Sissies at the Picnic, Roger Ferguson's actually proposing that there were always spaces in black communities for queer people. That they were your, not just stereotypically your hairdressers and your choir directors or what have you, but there were folk places there. But that the cutoff point for him was that when HIV and AIDS hit, that sort of was pushed away. And so it does some fracturing to a community that was also being hit economically, you know. And so that fracturing, you know, had a lot to do with the way that people seek what I call sort of a what I think is totally incorrect, the homogenized black community. There are black communities. There are immigrant black communities. There's so many varied communities just in New York alone. But people want to believe that they're, and it's interesting because even though you're saying that folks are going, how do they live, how do we develop communities where folks are being who they are, black queer folk, where in some communities these things are still happening. So we can't, it's hard to generalize around these things. I think
the
hyper-masculinity.
Church one of those places?
Church is definitely one of those places where people can sort of, I guess, you know, commune with the spirit and be accepted for, I guess, who they are in some regard. In that sort of like thinly veiled, if you acknowledge that you're a sinner, you know, and you're here to do that business, then yeah. But I also feel like that the churches and there are other places where people are doing some of that work, overwhelmingly no. Because the black community doesn't look at sexuality in general. The whole down low conversation was not about sexuality. It was about some phantom black bisexual man infecting black women with HIV. And so we're still at a very sort of elementary level in terms of talking about these issues en masse. If I picked up another Essence magazine where someone was talking about some down low man, I was going to go crazy.
It's true.
Do you know? Or a book about some down low person. In fact, it became kind of sexy for people. Mm. It was a cash cow for others. Mm. Go on Oprah, and Oprah's like, yes, this is happening, oh my God. You know, and I'm like, so you got the big O on it. That's a problem, do you know? Because you don't talk about sexuality. You don't talk about gender. You talk about this opportunity, I think, today is a really interesting conversation to have in the Schomburg. It's the Schomburg Center was the first institution to collect black queer material. The first. And when I started the Black and Lesbian Archive in 1999, this was the only place I wanted it to come because they already had a space for it. Do you know? The reason why I'm bringing these things up, I want to complicate these conversations about black queerness and gender performance and actually, you know, hip-hop. How hip-hop is definitely, at one point, everybody's, you made me feel, and then it was, rah, 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 and it was like... I feel like I've gone from A-tracks to cassettes to CDs, and the music has definitely done some interesting things to the way we see ourselves as men and how women sign on to that. Mm-hmm. Mark Anthony was a part of a conversation recently with three other brothers around, do we want a new kind of black male? I say no. I say in some ways people are quite comfortable with the images they have of black men as being the clown, the superhero, the suit, the thug or what have you. Mm-hmm. And I think that oftentimes when you're pushed out of those that community in some ways do you start to look at this stuff. I want to end there and I want to say if you have any questions, I'd like to open it up to the audience right now. There's a mic over here.
Let me say
I apologize.
Say one quick thing though about the Michael Jackson in his bedroom.
Okay.
I go with Reborn's point. That there's a certain kind of purity and innocence to his response to those charges. Mm-hmm. And your point about class, I think, is important here. Mm-hmm. When we think about his family, the 10, 11, 12 of them, God forbid anybody comes over to visit, who comes to stay in the house.
I know, right?
You can best believe there were some children sleeping in beds with adults. And their family is not some unique example, right? That's about what it meant to be poor and black and have very little space to exist, whether it's in tenements in Chicago or shotgun houses in the South, right? Mm-hmm. The reality is that people lived on top of each other, right? Mm-hmm. Which meant it was not unusual that your children shared your bed with you, right? And so in that context, right, if Michael Jackson's only context for family really is those early days in Gary, Indiana, right? And Netherland is an attempt for him to recreate some semblance of family, right, in the way that he can control it. Why would it be unusual for him to think, well, we've always slept in the bed with our parents, right? Why wouldn't I do the same thing? Because that was a sign of black hospitality.
Right.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Something else I want to add to the conversation. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I will add to that that I am far more confident that O.J. Simpson killed Nicole Brown and that R. Kelly raped that 13-year-old than I am that Michael Jackson had sexual relations with young boys.
Well, when you put it like that.
I'm not sure why you're clapping, but okay. We all somebody else here.
Right.
She wanted to add a few questions.
Something that I want to add to the conversation in thinking about Michael Jackson and masculinity, which is like what manhood must have appeared to be to him based on his abusive father and a tender yet seemingly passive mother.
Seemingly passive,
because we don't know everything. But if being a quote man, you know, like Joe was manhood to Michael Jackson, if that's his perception of manhood, then we can see why he didn't want any part of it and why he became the anti-Joe. I'm not going to dominate other beings. I'm not going to dominate other people. I can be a man and not do these things. And I absolutely think that that could have played a very large role in how he moved through the world, how he progressed, and how he exhibited masculinity and manhood as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that is... I think that you have to fight to love who... you have to fight to love all of who you are, especially your blackness, in this world. And Michael Jackson... Like the speculation around, or why he wouldn't come out if he was gay, is like because you have to. Everything is at stake. You know, your religion. Can you be part of a cultural community? Can you? Were there gay people in the Black Panther Party? You know, like things to think about. You know, like what can't
or,
you?
Or in the Nation of Islam.
Or in the Nation of Islam. I mean, I know that there were people in the Nation of Islam who. I know there was a brother who committed suicide because he was scared to come out. Like, when you join community, but then you become part of a monster that will, you feel like will be out to get you if you say who you are, but this is, but your spirit attracts you to this community.
Right.
Like, so there's certain choices that, you know, people make based on if they want to still be, you know, part of this community or not. And it's a shame that people have to negotiate, you know, their spirituality. Like, as many gay folks go to church, as many, like, even the mosques, like, mosques are so, there's a word, homosocial, that hopefully people know. And if you don't, homosocial, you know, men over here, women over here, like guys on the corner only talking to guys, holding their crotches around guys, like
it's very hip-hop.
Me and my boys, like it's that's all homosocial. So, but then to think that you're praying with people, you're praying around a bunch of men and you don't think any of them ever had the thought of being, you know, it's just like crazy. Like the fact that you just think like it wouldn't happen. And so all of that builds up to people creating other worlds, and which we, you know, were able to see because Michael was able to create it on a large scale because of the money that he had. And I think that we all would want to create our own worlds based on the amount of money we had. But yeah.
There is, before I turn it over to the folks who would like to make comments, the director of the center, outgoing director, in February of 2011, Howard Dotson, wrote a piece about Michael Jackson that I thought was really interesting. And in it, he talks about Michael Jackson being an icon. And so I just wanted to read it if I could find it. So you'll have to read it later. I apologize. I have it right here. And how icons sort of, the icon takes over the person after a while, based on the choices, but based on the context of that particular community. And that Michael Jackson put art, I think the last time he put art in front of anything was Thriller. That was his last moment. I think Bad was calculated in a very deliberate sense to have as many singles as possible. And I do think musically it wasn't that sharp. It was catchy, but it wasn't off the wall. It wasn't Thriller. He says about Michael Jackson that becoming an icon has its price. Icons frequently consume, confuse, and destroy their host. They compete with and frequently engulf the real self. They rob the person of their identity and privacy and then turn them into objects of prey, subvert normal human relations, and induce aberrant behavior. Witness icons like Elvis, Anna Nicole Smith, and most recently Heath Ledger. Such was the case with Michael Jackson. So I just kind of want to put that in your head for a second. And as we have some time for questions, please make your comments and your questions succinct. We appreciate it, so that as many people have an opportunity to join the conversation. Go right ahead.
Okay, in 30 words or less.
Let's go.
You all know Muscles by Diana Ross, right?
Yeah.
Which he wrote and produced for Diana Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is a very interesting song to bring into this discussion, because allegedly when she heard the song, her response was, "Michael, is this my fantasy or yours?"
Hmm.
And so I open up to the panel, what is Michael's response to that?
Good people. I want muscles. Ooh.
You know, one can be heterosexual and desire the aesthetic value of the masculine figure.
Work it out.
I mean, that's what bodybuilding is, you know, for all intents and purposes.
Did Michael want muscles all over his body, figuratively, or?
Or did he want muscles all over his body?
Any more comments?
I'm actually glad you raised that song. I love that song, and I remember listening to it as a kid and just thinking it was kind of a jam. But I don't. At the time, I didn't have a political opinion about it. And then later on, it caught my attention again as an adult, and I was like, "Wait, he wrote?" And that was pretty much the end of my process with it, only because I don't care if Michael Jackson was or wasn't gay. I don't care. I don't think, like Sally said, in my heart, whatever that means to me,
right. Mm-hmm.
That he was.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he was, I don't care. I still love him the same. My heart is still as, you know, open to him. And I have no problem with if he wrote "I Want Muscles" because he wanted that for himself, or he wanted someone with muscles to come into his life and be with him.
Wasn't Muscles a snake?
What'd you say?
Wasn't Muscles a snake?
Was Muscles a snake?
I think Muscles was a snake, yeah.
His body?
I mean, it was a python or something. I don't remember. But I remember just being terrified of the whole idea.
Well, hey.
Gentleman in the hat. You're on.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for speaking with us. I've enjoyed it. But you all kind of was comical about, and so people in the audience as well, is about Catherine saying that her son was not gay. Now, as a young gay man, and not a lot of other young gay men that I know, they all say, and everyone has said, that the mother knows, and my mother knew, and a lot of mothers have known. So why were you comical about that?
No,
go ahead.
When I said it was comically naive, she said you can look at a person and tell whether they're gay or not. I don't think she was specifically talking just about Michael. I think she was sending a general statement that, you know, you'd be able to tell if somebody was gay.
Well, she said she looked at her son as well.
I think that's kind of ridiculous, huh?
She said she looks at Michael in his eyes and she knows that her son is gay, and you can look at a person to see that. I know she said that, but I'm just saying, mothers do know.
Intuitively, yes, his mother would probably know about him specifically, but my commentary was really about the general statement of being able to look at somebody and identify whether they were gay or not.
Okay.
I think it's a little...
I thought that was Mark speaking. Just because she said that doesn't mean that's how she really felt. And oftentimes, there's a great book called Does Your Mama Know? About coming out. A mother can say all kinds of things for what she hopes is true about her child, knowing full well that it's not.
No, I totally understand that.
Yeah.
You all thought it was comical that she would even say that. And coming as a gay young man, and a lot of my gay friends, the mother do.
I'll say this. I respect the fact, you know, I respect your experience, but I know mothers that didn't know that their sons or daughters were gay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I don't think it's it's a blanket statement, I think. I mean, I understand your perspective, but the people don't know. Sometimes the poor gay person doesn't know they're gay. I mean, so.
right.
I mean.
Yeah.
I laughed at it because all my life I've heard similar statements. He's walking down the street and it's just a guy who's a dandy. He likes women. He just likes bow ties or whatever, you know?
Thanks, Farnsworth Bentley.
So, I mean, there are a lot of men and women who are butch and or feminine, and they're cast as homosexual immediately. And so behavior does not dictate a sexual identity. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. And I also thought about how, I mean, I was also maybe laughing about the lies, like, that she's been taught, that religion teaches you in terms of, like, how to develop your eyes to think, like, oh, I can, you know, I have the power to see, you know, that everybody's straight, you know, like, but, like, you know, it's because, yeah, like, a mother knows, yeah. But she was also thinking through the eyes of a mother who's a Jehovah's Witness. You know, I know, like, that's part of her experience, and we learned through our experience, and she wanted to see her son as someone. When you want to see somebody as someone who's going to, someone that you love, as someone that's going to make it to heaven, and you think that if you say that they're gay, that they're going to go to hell, like, I don't know too many parents who want to fix their mouths to say, like, my son is gay and he's going to go to, you know, like, hell, if that's what they feel is the truth for them. So I think that, and then people believe in speaking things into existence. Too bad sexuality is usually not one of those things you can do.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I don't think Michael Jackson was gay either. I think he was just kind of shy. But anyway. And I do think he went to heaven. But the only thing that kind of hurt me and disturbed me was his, I think at one point he just started identifying more white. Like, he started hanging out with a lot of white people. He was like Elizabeth Taylor's adopted son. You know, all the kids were all white around him. He adopted or fathered or whatever those three white kids, and now they're getting all his money that he left. And I just wanted to know what you guys think about that, how sometimes black men that are really successful leave the black community and go off into this, you know, other world. And, you know, and we always take him back, too. You know, like when he came to Harlem, you know, and we all surrounded him and supported him. But that was the only thing that was, you know, disturbing to me about him. But I really loved him, though.
You know, there's this definition of Michael Jackson as being peerless. And to put that in a finer point, who would Michael Jackson's peers have been? You know, how many people sold 100 million records that aren't, like, dead? All right, I'm talking to Elvis in this kind of context. And, you know, I mentioned all this. That there's some interesting footage of Steve Harvey on the Gospel Network.
I just read your piece
back in October.
Yesterday.
And he's talking with Donnie McClurkin, and Donnie McClurkin's 100 million audience. And he has this nervous breakdown on the air, right, trying to maintain this facade of being who Steve Harvey is today. And what the critical point of his comments were, when I'm struggling, I don't have anybody to talk to, right? I got my boys, but my boys don't know nothing about this, right? He goes, I try to call T.D. Jakes, I try to call you, Bishop be busy. And it was just this whole thing about him not having anyone to talk to because of who he is at this point in time. And I just imagine what that must have been like for Michael Jackson, right? He can't even talk to his brothers, right? Brothers ain't got his talent. Haven't had his level of success, right? Maybe Jermaine, right? Jermaine can sing better than he can, but that's about it, right? Much more of a hair nightmare. I mean, this. I mean, who does Michael Jackson talk to, right? It makes you wonder, you know, if Michael Jackson had access to, yeah, exactly, right? Bubbles, right? It makes you wonder that, like, if Michael Jackson had access to technology like this, might he actually, like, just still be alive? Right. If he would have had somebody that he could just, you know, like NBA ball players, right? Like Kobe and LeBron can just text each other, right? Doesn't have to be some photo op in the airport like MLK and Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. I mean, who does Michael Jackson talk to, right? So you can understand why he would gravitate, you know, to the people that he did to, right? Right. But even in the case of other black icons, there's nobody like Michael Jackson, right? Maybe he could talk to Sammy Davis Jr. Maybe Quincy helped on some level, right? But when you think about his age and the level of that kind of moment, right, of course he would talk to Paul McCartney,
right? You know, before there was Jackson Mania, there was Beatlemania, mm-hmm. right? Paul McCartney know a little bit about something. Of course, he's going to talk to Elizabeth Turner, Elizabeth
Taylor.
If Judy Garland had still been alive,
he
would have talked to her. But he had he had a daughter, right? He could talk to Liza Minnelli. Right, so I think part of it is like, and I don't want to discount what happens when people get separated from community and community gets separated from them. Mm-hmm. But at the bottom line, I think part of this is also about him trying to find a peer group that could ever figure out, right? Mm-hmm. Even the marriage to Lisa Marie.
Right.
Right, you know, Elvis is dead. He can't have that conversation with Elvis, but he can have that conversation with Lisa Marie. Mm.
I think also, you know, this is an unfortunate point where we recognize the disconnect between Prince and Michael Jackson, because if they could have had a bond like that, mm-hmm. there could have been some possible sustenance of emotional well-being between the two of them, because they were each other's peers. There's the only other black person that I think could have possibly related to Michael Jackson was Prince.
Hell, they could have talked about Jehovah's Witnesses.
Boom. Right. But they didn't talk.
Maybe not then.
Not that we know of. That we know of.
Kind of out,
yeah.
We don't know that, but.
So, yeah.
I guess I have a problem with... Is it a problem? I want to complicate what you're saying, Mark, a little bit more, that this whole notion of him not being able to speak to someone in his peer group, he still had the opportunity to talk to people. They may not totally have understood what he was going through, but he also made a choice. So why were they all white icons? They could have been, like you said, he could have talked to Sammy Davis Jr. He could have talked to a number of people who've had some level of success and could have understood that when they go to a supermarket, they get mobbed. I understand.
But how do we know that he didn't have those conversations?
Exactly.
See, that's
exactly.
my question. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Jason King, when he does his little obituary piece on Luther Vandross, right, mm-hmm. you know, he talks about the fact that Vandross regularly calls Sylvester. Right. How did you negotiate this? Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sylvester chose to come out. Luther never did. Right. In part because of the conversations he had with Sylvester about the dynamics.
Okay. And so it's all whom Michael chose. You know, I still think it's still an unresolved thing.
Or what becomes publicly meaningful to a media that is fixated with who Michael Jackson is.
Right.
Right.
It kind of reminds me,
which is why people are so right. You know, who is the promoter for their 1984 victory tour?
Al Sharpton.
Y'all know who that was?
Don King.
It was Don King.
Don King.
Right? Yeah. And everybody was like, Don King, why the hell are y'all working with Don King? Mm. Right?
Crazy Don King.
As if there wasn't a relationship with the Jackson family and Don King for a decade, right, that made that a logical choice.
Wow.
And so what we're going to do, I'm sorry, to make sure that we hear from people who have comments is actually take two questions at a time, if you don't mind actually taking notes.
Okay.
And then we're going to end the questions at the person at the last. But if we can just limit the questions to like 1 minute so we can hear from everyone on the panelists.
Okay.
All right. So mine is more of a comment, and you know, I know a lot of you guys up there and respect you and your work. Basically, earlier, Asadila, when you're talking about the DL thing and the black community and the spiritual community and why, you know, Michael may not have wanted to quote unquote come out, or why a lot of black men don't come out, or, you know, what's up with black males' sexuality, you know. I mean, just the fact that, yeah, if you do try to talk to someone, who are you going to talk to, really? If you are in a Islamic community, a Christian community, or whatever that is, someone may pat you on the back and comfort you, but say, baby, you need to go pray and ask the Lord to take that out your heart. Do you know what I'm saying? So we can't necessarily walk around the world feeling safe. You don't feel safe. You know, I live in a Caribbean community. No one knows who I am. I don't broadcast who I am. But based on how I look, people make assumptions and scream all types of things at me. They don't know what I'm doing. I had to accept the fact that although I'm fighting for my people, I'm standing up for my people, I live for my people, I may have to take somebody out this world one day for the fact that they come face to face to me and try to take me out.
Right.
Another black man or a black woman. Black women, you know, you can speak up, you can say, they're like, oh, why all these men on a DL, da, da, da. But, you know, if you speak up, who's going to be down with you? So, you know, well, you my girlfriend now, we're going to be girlfriends? No, I'm a man. You know, I'm a man. And men have all types of different colors and shades. And we can be all types of different things. And that is one of the things that Michael, Prince, you guys, everybody here, we contribute to every single day. Stretching the boundaries of black men.
Thank you.
Hey.
Hello, good afternoon. Once again, my name is Kiara Beverly. For all y'all that missed the first part of the event, I just wanted to say that, you know, y'all was talking about the part where Michael was wearing the wigs and he was wearing lip gloss and all that. You know, as a teenage kid, I seen that on TV. And growing up, you know, I was introduced to so much things. So I was like, oh, my God. Michael's gay. I can't believe this, you know. Now my Michael, then it was like, I think it was the Rock With You video he had came out with, and his skin was like a little bit lighter and stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, now he's like trying to be white. And I like really didn't understand because it wasn't so clear to me. But, you know, as time passed, I actually got a sense that, you know, he was definition of self-love. And he was open enough with himself to accept himself that, you know, to come out in the public and say, hey, this is me and this is who I am. So I respect him for that because he made me see that not only, like, you know, it's something more out there in the world, you know, to help people, you know, like, you can see... Like, many people can grow through his experience and just by watching him, you know? So I just really thank him for that.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask a question to DJ Reborn. I remember, yeah, I'm sorry. I just, she said, yeah, she said, you know, that you was very into astrology. I just wanted to ask if, what was your intake on Aries? Because I'm an Aries.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that later, sweetie. I have a lot to say about
DJ
y'all.
Reborn is going to be giving out astrological forecast for everyone in the audience as a part of your consolation prize. Look under your seat. It's you get a free reading. There you go. Yes, miss.
Okay.
I'll be right there. I just had a quick question about Michael Jackson's, or what was put out there is his romantic relationships, and if you all thought those were performances as well. I'm thinking, I mean, Mark brought up Lisa Marie, and I know I always hear about him and Brooke Shields being tight, and I mean, people have already brought up his relationships with different famous white women, and people have always said, oh, he wants to look like a white woman, or that's, you know, what he was, like, going toward. And so I was wondering, how would you put that in a mix in this conversation?
I actually, are we not? Okay.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to touch on a couple of quick things that DJ Reborn said. Okay, well, the one big thing then. You mentioned earlier about Michael's exposure to the abusive kind of masculine, I guess, iconography that his father was. You know, very masculine, very gruff, and that was kind of his reaction to say, I'm not going to be that hyper-masculine. I'm wondering if some of his early exposure to hypersexuality, like, you know, being exposed to the strip clubs, exactly, watching his father engage in a lot of extramarital affairs. I'm sure everybody knows that he has like a 35-year-old, 36-year-old half-sister, at least.
Right.
So I was just really curious about, you know, even his responses to what could be considered as sexually abusive environments, mm-hmm, and how that affects not only him, but I think us as a people as well. There's a lot of sexual abuse and exploitation that we don't talk about, mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm, actually affects us as we walk out of this museum today. So I was just curious as to what your response
Research
was.
Center, not like, not museum, but go ahead.
Oh.
Thank you for your question. We'll just go ahead and take all the questions and then we'll just answer them so everyone has an opportunity to speak.
Hi. I didn't have really a question. I had more of a comment. I know it was touched on a little bit by the panel, but I remember when Saad was saying that everyone was concerned about, you know, male sexuality. I think we were really too concerned about his sexuality and his queerness or whatever you want to call it, and we weren't really concerned enough about his mental health. And I'm not just, even before I was a mental health professional, I knew that there was something going on with Michael, with his upbringing. Something was traumatic to him that made him in this infantile state where he stayed cognitively in childhood. So when the child molestations and him hanging out with children came out, I never even went there with the molestation. My thought was, this is a man who's clearly had some childhood trauma and he's stuck in this period, which is why he had the amusement park in his house. His favorite cartoon character was Peter Pan, the boy who never didn't want to grow up. All these things and led to his body dysmorphic, which I believe he had. I don't think it was self-love at all. I think he had a self-loathing because he wanted to change himself outwardly because he wasn't happy with himself inwardly. And it was due to his, you know, I believe his abusive upbringing. So I think if we spent more time thinking about his mental health and kind of embracing him and trying to get him help or even not being so critical and taking that to effect, he wouldn't have suffered all that he did during life with us being so critical and everyone tearing him down. So I think we needed to be more aware of his mental health.
Good afternoon. My name is Deborah, and we've touched on a lot of different topics and a lot of social issues, but the main thing that I hope that everyone can focus on is the video that I observed in reference to the planet. I can't remember the name of that video, but I thought that was so profound. And if people don't really internalize that video, all of these social issues will be irrelevant because we will all be at a point where it's all about rudimentary survival, primal survival, just being alive as a person. How to eat, whatever. All of this would be irrelevant. So I hope people will focus more on that. That's a very, very fantastic, excellent, excellent video. And I encourage everyone also to have their children watch it and have topics of conversation and ways that they can help in trying to make people have respect for the planet.
The interesting thing was while the interview was running, there's a still photograph that I think might have been a part of the slideshow earlier of Stephanie Mills and Michael Jackson sitting together looking at each other in this very particular way that kids who like might be attracted to each other would look. And she was maybe 16 or 17 and he still had his afro and brown and the original nose. And she was very adamant about emphasizing, and not even in a defensive way, that, you know, that was kind of her boyfriend for a second. And they kissed, but they didn't sleep together. And I think we don't think about Michael Jackson ever being attracted to a black woman, but he had a relationship, allegedly, with Stephanie Mills when they were kids, and I stared at that picture for so long because it just looked like real energy. Mm-hmm. You know when you see people that are just attracted to each other, there's a look that they have, and if you're able to capture it, it speaks for itself. So it was refreshing for me to see that and to focus on it.
And that gets back to that peer point, that peer group. I had a chance to talk to Stephanie a couple months ago, and the Michael Jackson thing came up. And, you know, the first time, and some of you are from New York, right? The first time I saw Michael Jackson on television was Michael Jackson and Stephanie Mills appearing on Wonderama. Right, which is a, you know, show that was a kid's show that was done here locally. And again, this issue of peer group, right? If you're Michael Jackson and you are who you are, who do you talk to? Well, Stephanie Mills is now the star of The Wiz, right? It made perfect sense. You know, she said she in fact signed to Motown after The Wiz in part because she wanted to be, you know, she wanted to be Mrs. Jackson at some point.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
And that gets to that whole point of the Michael that we think about who he was to certain audiences in the 1970s.
Right.
And when he decides to leave the Chitlin Circuit behind and move on to something else.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to respond quickly to the point about Michael's mental health, right?
Yes.
Which I think is a point that's very well taken, and very well taken for black folks in general. Right. We need to do significant work about our collective mental health.
Absolutely.
That said, you know, Michael Jackson created a body of text that he clearly encouraged us to consider critically and theoretically in this way, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Michael Jackson wanted us to have these conversations. That's why his videos were so provocative, right? That's why at some point his music was so provocative, right? It, you know, it's the genius of art, right? Art is put out there for us to have to grapple with its meanings, right? Despite the kind of day-to-day realities that the artists themselves might in fact be, you know, dealing with.
And I wanted to say that I think that, you know, I was married to a woman for 6 years, and I think that there's a lot of performance in marriage, like straight, gay, or, you know, whatever the case, like there's a lot of performance in marriage. If anybody's been married, you may know what I'm talking about, in terms of, you know, just like how people how people perceive you. Do you look like you're doing good? Do you look like you're still in love? You know, do you look happy? Is he wearing his ring? You know, just all of those things. So it's hard. And marriage is really personal. I mean, we like to get in people's business a lot. And marriage is something that's so personal. Like, you don't know what's going on in somebody's home. You know, like, we just don't know. So it's really hard to say, like, if things were a performance or not, when I think that a lot of us are trained to perform as husband and as wife. I think we're taught that from young, like, what that should look like to be a husband, what should it look like to be a wife, but then you have to make a decision if this is something that, you have to make a decision if you're happy, and I think, like, that's, we should maybe chase the answers to those questions, like, what makes us happy terms of when we're in love, and, and what kind of life we want to create for ourselves, and give us the opportunity to recreate and recreate and recreate. And I think that that's something that maybe, you know, that's what Kiara brought up for me when she said self-love. Like, I thought about him not saying, like, oh, my skin is lighter, like, take the cameras off of me, you know, or, like, him being able to, he was documented, his recreation of himself was constantly documented. And many of us are not brave enough to document the ways that we recreate ourselves, like a Luther Vandross, like, you know, so many people who we don't know. It's speculation. So, yeah.
Excellent. The other question dealt specifically with Michael Jackson in the context of living in a sexually abusive environment, how that may have shaped his sensibilities. Does anyone on the panel want to address that before we close?
I think it affected his sensibilities. It's tied into how he developed, or the lack thereof, of development of relationships with women. And I think that, you know, the exposure to so much so young, and the pressure to continually perform, and not be a child, really foiled so many chances that may have been in terms of creating a real relationship, having some sense of normalcy in the scope of a relationship. So I think that it really did taint him as a child, and it really did affect the way he grew into adulthood, because it was so one-sided. And there was, you know, that missing childhood that we all are, you know, aware of. And I think that it largely affected the way he viewed women, whether he felt that he could trust a woman or not. I think there were a handful of women in his life, those, you know, who he's been openly seen with, you know, the Diana Rosses, you know, the Elizabeth Taylors, the Brooke Shields. There were women that he came to embrace and trust as figures that, you know, were maybe nurturing and somewhat maternal to him. But I think that there was definitely dysfunction or some level, I don't want to use the word sham, or some level of performance in the relationship with Lisa Marie, as with the whole Debbie Rowe thing. That's just, you know, that's a whole thing in and of itself, you know, with the children and all. But was that a real relationship? No. I mean, it might have been a friendship at some point, but it wasn't a viable, functional male-female relationship in a traditional sense. So I think that exposure to, you know, the hypersexuality, the strip clubs, whatever you want to call it, as he grew up and as he performed in that circuit, really did affect his ability to maintain, again, some normalcy and relationship in the construct of a male-female, you know.
And even his exposure to his older brothers. I mean, Jackie and Jermaine were hoes.
Yes, right. And supposedly he would, you know, they were all in the bed, and they're in the bed with, you know, their girlfriends, their women, the girls that they took back from, you know, the concert or the club or whatever. Like, you know, they were a little bit older than him. They were, you know, enjoying the experience of being a young teenage star, and he wasn't there yet. You know, he was a child, yet and still he was exposed to, you know, very adult scenarios as a child, which made probably him even regress even further sexually. and cause this, you know, some queerness, if you want to talk about that, you know, again, coming to light, you know, as an adult. It was just, you know, this constant suppressed or repressed sexuality based on maybe what he'd seen, a real trauma.
I think also just to take it back to the beginning of this panel when Lene showed the video for Keep It in the Closet, and just that sense of sort of distance between Michael Jackson and Naomi Campbell, but they were supposed to be having this sexualized interaction. But I don't know about you guys, I didn't get that from it. I felt like the ultimate black female body, that is Naomi Campbell, was there gyrating, like ready for the taking, and he kept a very safe distance. It was like these two bodies were moving, but there wasn't chemistry there.
And I think that's what Asad said about performance.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a performance of a performance.
It was a performance of a performance, which, again, you know, the strip club and the exposure to all the things maybe had him create that distance where, like, I don't want to be disrespectful to women. I don't want to go too far.
Which is interesting,
And I think that it's hard. We don't have too many examples of healthy sexuality.
Like, I know.
Especially amongst black folks. I don't know too many, you know, celebrities to call on and say they're a healthy example of what, you know, it is to be heterosexual or to be homosexual. Like, so I don't know if we haven't gotten there yet. You know, it's sad when you have those moments like black people, we haven't gotten there yet. Like, I just had that. Like, we haven't gotten there yet to have healthy examples of sexuality. You know, we want to have healthy models of what it is to be of, like, marriages and, like, of family, which is kind of put on, but not healthy.
It's more like survival rather than the actual exploration of what you said earlier about what really makes you happy and having the guts and having the ability to go after it. So I totally agree with you.
And I hate to insert myself here, yet I don't hate to insert myself here. But just because I knew that this particular panel, which I struggled because I wanted to be on it, and I put myself on several panels, like, where do I want to be? I want it. And so finally, I'm going to insert myself and say one thing, which is that, first of all, I appreciate Mark Anthony Neal changing the language. I agree that Michael Jackson is queer, which means that he had the capacity to love both man or woman or both. The capacity, I think, is important because he's a human being. And I am curious about the negative impact that homophobia has on our mental health. And I am curious about whether or not people would have been able to love Michael Jackson had he been openly gay. Do we have the tools to love Michael? Would we have had the tools to love Michael Jackson if he was openly gay?
Well, let's just quickly look at the response to speculation about Google.
Right.
Right, exactly, yeah.
You know, if you would have asked me 5 years ago, I would have thought we would have been much more mature in our response to the possibility that someone might be a same gender-loving person. But when you see some of the responses, you know, in the Twitterverse and Facebook and all these other places, I mean, clearly folks are disconcerted by the possibility that Guru could have been gay.
Right.
You know, the fact that when you think about the response to Luther Vandross, you know, Luther Vandross very consciously went against any speculation that he loved anybody.
Right.
You couldn't tell whether or not he loved men or he loved women. I mean, he just left that as open-ended for all those very specific kinds of reasons. So, I think it would have been incredibly difficult. And, you know, Michael Jackson sensed that. If you look at Michael Jackson's body of work in, you know, what AJ calls the Black Power moment, he clearly is responding to what has been a shift in the cultural terrain. Right. There are now examples by the early 1990s of a hyper-masculine black masculinity that is crossing over. I mean, that's what hip-hop is. Right. And so when you see a video like Remember the Time, you know, which is his conscious performance of heterosexuality, right, that we have never seen in him before, right, all the fascination with the on-screen kiss with Iman. Right. And I mean, he's performing all of these things in this particular moment, right? Let's have R. Kelly write a song for right, you know, let's get black producers, right, that young black producers that kind of capture this kind of heterosexual, hyper-masculine moment musically in this particular period of time. I mean, he was very conscious that there was a shift, right? The marriage to Lisa Marie, I think, was part of that performance, right? Their performance on the MTV Awards,
mm-hmm. right, where he reproduces the kiss with Amon with Lisa Marie, right? Mm-hmm. This whole pattern, just like Al Gore and Tipper, right, at the 2000
right.
convention.
Right.
You know, and he was very conscious of the speculation of all these things because he, of course, had to be privy to the speculation around someone like Uta Vandross mm-hmm. and a range of other artists. And, of course, I think you're right. HIV changes the conversation mm-hmm. at that mm-hmm. point in time, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's looking for the gay, dead bodies in the closet.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
And he has to perform against that if he wants to remain right, at that moment at least, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's a different conversation if he's functioning in 2010, but still in 1992 where folks are still trying to wrap their heads around HIV.
Mm-hmm. Right? Still are.
And at least in the black community, mm-hmm. clearly still wrapping their heads around mm-hmm. homosexuality in real significant kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. He clearly made a move, right? And again, I don't think that says anything about who he was as a person in terms of his sexual desire.
Right, no, right? Exactly.
What he was mm-hmm. retreating on was a performance of an ambivalent masculinity, mm. right, that helped him to become Michael Jackson in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Retreating, yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Well.
Please. I'm sorry. Please.
It's a damn shame that I don't think he would be as loved as much if he was gay. Because we live in a I got you kind of world. Like, I can't believe, oh, no, not him. You know, like, that's, you know, we hope that every black man is straight. I mean, that's what the, you know, and it's not even about, too bad it's not even about, like, oh, we want to bring some more smart baby geniuses in the world and we want to make sure they... Because, I mean, you could do that either way. If you're straight or gay, you could bring a child in the world. But it's, it's not about building. It's about just being able to accuse and the fun of, you know, the investigation of people's lives.
It's the inability to really look at, I think, people to really look at themselves and look at their own sexual desires and look at their own desires and wants, honestly. That's what I think. I think that shifting of that, ooh, you, is really someone going, I can't even bear to form the questions about myself. Do you know? Mm-hmm. So
I think also in this era, like, the expectation is that we're past a point where people have a negative judgment or assessment about otherness, whatever that means, and that's absolutely not true, hence why there continues to be speculation about whether or not Oprah Winfrey is gay, hence the speculation around Queen Latifah's mm-hmm. sexuality, and if these women are in fact identified in their personal lives as that, they have chosen not to be public about it, and mm-hmm. there is something within that that says, well, you're black, and you're rich, and you're famous. Why not just come out? And it's like, well, because they understand the consequences that who cares if this is 2010? You will still be marginalized because you are saying that you are something.
This ain't Elton John. This ain't Ellen DeGeneres.
Mm.
Right.
No.
Right.
It's a different kind of something.
Right, yeah.
I think, what's his name? Sort of not Tevin Campbell.
Yeah,
you know, got caught up.
Got destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, where's his career today?
What is he doing now?
And there's a real health risk for if we keep mm-hmm. continuing in the way that we are. Like, there's a real health risk for everyone, you know, mm-hmm. HIV and AIDS. If people are not allowed to be honest and people have to operate with a fear of being loved by mm-hmm. everyone from their parents to, you know, being employed. You know, it's just
yeah, mm-hmm.
it runs the gamut.
Oh, well, thank you.
So, I'd like to thank the panelists today. DJ Selly, Mark Anthony Neal, Asad Muhammad, and DJ Reborn. You guys are wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your contributions to this panel.